Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Only two pieces grace the program for your next Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra performances, but those pieces will offer you lots of drama as well as a little taste of heaven. To chat about what you'll hear, our RPO Music Director Ward Stair and soprano Emily Bersan, welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Great to see you.
Welcome back, Ward. Have you two worked together before?
We have. We did a Beethoven 9 together a few years ago, I think. Is that right? And we worked together in Chicago, too. Emily was in the Young Artist Program at the Lyric Opera Chicago when I was there. We did a Rising Stars concert together,
yeah.
I think. And and I think you sang... I remember you had to step in and do the Lucia right at Grant Park, didn't you?
Oh, yes,
in
yes,
that one
yes.
rehearsal, when Albina was late. I forget all the circumstances, but yes, we have worked together. So we go way back.
Yeah, I thought I saw Lyric Opera of Chicago on your resume, and I thought, I wonder.
That's the connection.
Yeah. So what qualities, talk about her as if she's not here. What qualities about Emily's voice did you feel really fit the program that we're going to hear this week?
Well, I think her voice is perfect for this pairing because she has she's great with repertoire like the Bear because she's got such good pitch. She's got a good sense of drama and line. Her German's great, all those things that are important for the Bear. But also her voice lends itself well to the Mahler, which is supposed to be this pure, beautiful child's interpretation of what heaven must be like. And oftentimes when you get a pairing like this, and we were talking before you turned the mics on that I'm not the first conductor to think of this pairing, but oftentimes you get a singer who will sing one better than the other, or their voice is more suited to one versus the other. And I think Emily's voice is actually ideal for both, which is fantastic for our audiences and our orchestra this week.
Now, there is a link between these two, if you want to make it, between the Mahler and the Berg, because Berg loved this symphony. Mm-hmm. It was very dear to him.
Well, the two of them, I mean, they definitely overlapped, and Mahler very much was influential in Berg's development as a musician, and also the Mahler's love of song. I think Berg shared that for sure, so there are definitely connections.
You're in both pieces, Emily, and your roles in these two pieces are very different. You're so the Berg is what? Tell me about that.
The Berg, to me, they're separate songs written by different poets and kind of taken separately made into one. But I think he dedicated it to his wife, and so it's a love. I think it's a love. Set because a lot of them are very seductive, talking about being together in silence and just enjoying each other's presence, but also talking about bigger thoughts of life and what it means to love and what it means to be human. So that's what it is for me. It's really rich in poetry.
I don't know these well, so I listened to them yesterday for really the first time all the way through. And I was struck, Mr. Mahler or Mr. Strauss, I was struck thematically how similar they felt to me to the four last songs.
Oh, the four, that's interesting. I think also Strauss, when you talk about Mahler and Berg, you have to figure Strauss in there somewhere as well, because their languages, they're very different, of course, but their connections in the three were very, they knew each other and they were very influential. But I wouldn't... I see what you mean, I guess, with the arc of it and the storytelling and sort of that. Of course, at the end of Four Last Songs, you're kind of in a different place than you are at the end of the seven early songs of Berg. But it does have that interconnective quality about it, and that sort of satisfying end where you feel like you've experienced a wide range of emotions.
And a wide range of emotions that really touch on love.
Yeah, definitely. The melodies alone, too, have they're intricate in the sense that they're a little atonal, just a little bit, just enough. But I think that's what kind of connects the idea with Strauss is that it's so melodic. It's so sung. It's easy with the voice once you kind of wrap your head around the melody. it's easy to really sing into it.
And Berg had a great way. I mean, people who aren't that familiar with his music, they just hear, oh, it's 12-tone, and they just immediately sort of cringe. And but Berg was so, as Emily just said, so lyrical, so melodic, so lush. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you won't hear any chords. There are plenty of major chords and minor chords, and, you know, there's nice sonorities all over all the pieces. And the way that the craftsmanship is just excellent. I mean, it started just written for piano, and then he orchestrated it and kept revising it throughout his life. So he was, you know, he was constantly tweaking it. And originally there were 10 songs, I think, instead of 7. At the end of the day, what we're left with is just a beautiful, just 7 gems that fit together perfectly.
Yeah, he was a bit of an outlier in the Second Viennese schools. Mm-hmm. There was Schoenberg, there was Berg, there was Webern, and he kept going back to romantic influences. I understand this did not please Schoenberg, his teacher, very much at all.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He was quit playing those nice chords. Come on. Mm-hmm. Get with it. Get with the atonal thing. But it really is an extraordinary work. Do you have inside of these songs, Emily, is there one that really gets you?
Oh, man. They all kind of get me, but... Yeah, the fourth, is it the fourth song? I'm trying to remember, but I was showing Ward that I wrote, like I was saying, Cuddle on the top of my score. It's very simple. It feels like just a folk song.
Is that Crowned in Dream?
Yes, and it's, you know, it's especially the end. It's just how easy the minutes pass with, and in the middle, it's talking about my head on your knee. Just the simplicity of it, and the fact that the voice and the orchestra really work together, like in a recital with a piano. It's very intimate. It's not, you know, very orchestral feeling.
It's chamber music.
Yeah,
sure.
It's definitely chamber music. So I love that one. It's right smack dab in the middle of the piece, so it kind of grounds me and reminds me that I'm really just singing a song. Sometimes we have to, you know, remind ourselves that.
That's an interesting thought. Really, I'm just singing a song.
Yeah.
The first time you actually sang these, or you were told to sing these, or you were handed these to sing,
yeah.
What was your immediate impression of them?
Oh, I've always had a love for Berg, so I was really excited to dig in. But I think at first I knew it's going to take a lot of work to work them into my voice. And I did a recital in Wales with a pianist who had done them before. So I was taking ideas from him and bouncing ideas off. So I was really excited to dig deep.
Now you have a second role in this, and we actually will start this way because the symphony, Mahler's Symphony No. 4, was actually written backwards as well.
Mm-hmm.
This song itself, and we could start with that, was originally not meant for the Fourth Symphony at all.
Yeah, he thought about putting it in the Third Symphony originally. You know, he was always, especially in his early symphonies, he was constantly moving the puzzle pieces around and saying, well, okay, I think I'm going to take this movement, this song that I wrote in song cycle and include it here. And, you know, he wanted an earthly song and a heavenly song to contrast in the Third Symphony originally, and then he wasn't sure about that. And, I mean, we could talk about the evolution of the the first few symphonies for literally hours. But at the end of the day, the Fourth Symphony is really so different from the Second and Third, and the direction that everyone assumed he was headed after the Third Symphony was just bigger, 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 you know, these earth-shattering, all-encompassing works, and then all of a sudden he kind of threw us a curveball in the development of his symphonies by paring way back. I mean, there aren't as many brass people involved. There's no low brass, for example. It's just horns and trumpets in the Fourth Symphony. It's much shorter, relatively speaking, than 3, certainly, and 2, and 5, and most of the others.
All of them.
In fact, all of the others. And he really did begin with this song, and then he used elements which appear in the finale in the song and sort of developed them in the preceding 3 movements, which is a fascinating approach, actually, and the journey that he sets up for us takes us from, you know, the first movement, which is the most complicated and has all these really abrupt transitions, shifts of tempo, just a lot of ideas crammed into this one movement. And then he takes us through the second movement, which is a little bit simpler, but has its twists and turns. The third movement is kind of like this this beautiful journey up through the clouds to arrive at the pearly gates. And then when they open, you get this description of the heavenly life, which is the title of the song. But it's told through the eyes of a child. So it's got this purity and wonder about it, which is just incredible. And so by the end of the song, the child is sort of sings herself to sleep, and we're in this very peaceful place, and the symphony ends. You know, it's one of those endings that you almost don't want to interrupt the beautiful silence with applause. It's amazing.
David Zinman posited that this was a life cycle. So the first movement would be the happy first movement, you know, full of life. The second movement was the dance of death. As there is that folk song, Friend Hind strikes up about the Pied Piper. The third movement would be the death of transition. And of course, the fourth movement is heaven.
Right.
But Mahler himself really tried to, he didn't really state a program for this, did he?
Well, he didn't like when people assigned specific programmatic elements to his works because he thought it would limit the experience, I guess, both interpretively for those performing it and for those enjoying it in the audience. He wanted it to be more abstract. But I do think there are elements which we can point to. For example, the sleigh bells, though, in the opening, and they're also in the song, in the last movement, some people think, you know, that they're meant to be, actually people don't usually know what they are, but Mahler himself said, and it was recorded, that it's not supposed to be, out for a ride in the country with the reindeer or whatever. It's actually the bells on a jester's hat in a court, which actually changes the whole perspective on the first movement when you think about it from that angle, because there is a comic element to it, which you just alluded to, and it's more about life throws so many things at you, it's complicated, but you got to have fun, and you got to find moments to sing, you got to find moments to just laugh, you got to just take everything as it comes.
In fact, you've got to find moments to dance. I noticed when listening, there's an awful lot of that dance beat that pops up throughout.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the whole second movement, you know, a lot is made about the scordatura violin, which is it's an interesting color. It's a violin that's actually tuned up in pitch, so that the strings, the open strings, are not the typical strings starting on a G. They're actually higher by a step. And so what it does is it gives the whole instrument a more strident kind of color. It's a little bit less sweet and soft. And then you get the story, which is thrown in about the German fairy tale about the skeleton, you know, doing the dance of death and all that, which Mahler did. I forget exactly where he said that for the first time, but it did get recorded. But I think Mahler regretted the fact that it was associated so closely with the second movement because, again, people think it's this kind of danse macabre through and through, and it's not really. There are moments where death is nowhere near. It's actually a landler. It's a simple country dance. It's the only real. I mean, he wrote a landler in the first symphony, but this one is really. It's just pure folk music, and so there's singing and dancing involved. And I think part of the reason to give that scordatura color to the violin is because it sounds a little more rustic that way. You know, it's not sweet, refined, polished playing in the concert hall. It's supposed to be out in the countryside by the picnic tables with, you know, the cows in the distance and someone yodeling and people dancing on the tables and what, you know, it's fun. It's got to have that kind of atmosphere about it.
In the third movement, which David Zinman says is perfect, and I would have to agree with him, Mahler once said that at one point that was inspired by a vision of a tombstone on which was carved an image of the departed with folded arms in eternal sleep. I assume he kind of had to walk that one back as well.
Probably. I hadn't heard that one, actually. It is, I agree 100% with the perfection in the third movement. It's so beautiful. It's a simple theme and variations, you know, and he's got this wonderful, it almost feels like a Passacaglia in moments because of the bass line. And the two themes and the variations are alternated over this repeating bass line, which is almost like distant bell tones if you think about it a certain way. And it's the way it's all tied together is just, it's so beautiful. The struggle between lightness and darkness, it's sort of that, like you said, that final journey toward heaven. And when we get to the end, it's just, it's exquisite. It's exquisite.
And then it's the fourth movement.
Right. Right.
And then the little child, a.k.a. Emily Bersan, comes in to sing this vision of heaven. Now, I did a lot of reading around and poking around, and they say that finding the right voice for this, Emily, is really hard. I know Leonard Bernstein tried a
with a boy soprano, which was an idea that I think Mahler had at one point as well.
Didn't work.
No. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't awesome. The range, I understand, on this is a little, it can be a little difficult for a typical soprano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, it dips into what a lot of sopranos use chest voice for. It dips all the way down below the staff. But then it requires a very light passaggio and light, you know, fun text, right? So you don't ever want to get heavy talking about the, you know, all the food in heaven alone. There's just a lot to get your mouth around with the text, the apples and the pears and this childlike voice inside of me is describing what heaven is like. And so that, I think that's what makes it challenging vocally. And so you just have to work with it. I always tend to not get too heavy ever. I try to not be too heavy.
Think young, think light.
Yes, think young, think light, but open. And sharing my tone, because I think I try to keep a silvery quality to my voice, and as my voice teacher calls it, grainy. So it has that childlike, youthful, green sound.
A purity about it, is also.
Do you remember the first time you heard this?
Man. I studied in Vienna, and I had a Mahler class, and I heard it in that class. And I think I did hear Renee Fleming sing it that first time. So it was meaningful. I love the Third Symphony probably more, but this is beautiful and very unique that it has a voice just in the last movement. I think that's really interesting, a soprano solo.
Mm-hmm.
When you learned about Mahler in Vienna, what did you hear about this symphony?
Oh, man. I think the folksy quality of it for me, and ethereal, undescribable, that words can't really describe how human it is. It's just very human for me.
Not everybody liked this, the critics. They weren't all rah-rah on this one. It's probably one of my favorites. It isn't the grand gesture.
Yeah, it's different in that way.
It's something smaller, something subtler. It does something entirely different. It's an interesting symphony. Where was he in his life when he wrote this?
Well, he had recently been appointed music director of the Staatsoper in Vienna. You know, is the pinnacle. He had recently built Meiernig the summer home that he had on the lake, so he was in a very happy place, actually. But he also had recently had that first bout where he almost—he had a hemorrhage and he almost died, and so he was dealing with great success and great happiness, and also, you know, the fact that he was mortal. So, you know, And from that point on, you know, then we get the Fifth Symphony and then the Sixth, which it got darker and darker and darker. And he got more and more paranoid about his health. And, you know, he was a hypochondriac, and then he had the heart problem that was detected and all these things. But this is pre that. It's just at the beginning. It's kind of the end of his first period as a composer of development. And then we sort of go in with the Fifth Symphony to the second stage.
And then there was Alma.
Right. And, well, Alma, I think Alma shows up more... interestingly enough, in the Fifth Symphony, although she was in his life at this point, but I hear more references to her in the Fifth Symphony than in the Fourth. I think the Fourth is more about life in general. It's broader than one specific person for me, you know.
And it's interesting that this was when his first health crisis really happened, because that shows up in the symphony. It's this is not. This was just like the Pastoral Symphony has a storm. Mm-hmm. There is a little storminess in this.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, but I think it's also asking these big questions that we all ask ourselves at one point or another. You know, what is heaven? What is life? What is this journey about? You know, what are we hoping to achieve, and where do we want to be at the end of the day when we arrive at the end of our third movement and go into the fourth, you know? And I think his answer is kind of brilliant. He says, well, you know, life has its ups and downs. Life is complicated, but the purest thing is really just this childlike imagination and wonder and joy. And if you listen to the text also in the last movement, it's funny. I said to the orchestra at one of the rehearsals in the last couple of days, I said, you know, it's got to have this purity and wonderment about it, but it's also, you know, it shifts gears quickly, be like a child telling a story who gets so excited about every single idea, but then they completely jump to another idea without any transition whatsoever, and they're equally committed to that. And, you know, they're just as excited about the veggies and the fruit as they are about the butcher. And it talks about how the butcher, you know, Johannes, and they come and they have the oxes and the lambs who are being slaughtered. So, I mean, it's a little bit Brothers Grimm there as well. It's a German child, you know, fantasy. so it's very complicated, actually. But it's this really uncomplicated viewpoint that the child has, you know, and it's just so beautiful. And then after the child, you know, sort of describes all these things in the garden and how the angels bake the bread and all these things, there's this little interlude where the orchestra, that's when the lullaby begins that I was talking about. And then Emily comes back in and says, kein Musik ist ja nicht auf Erden. And it's like, you know, there's nothing like this on earth. We're now in a different place, which I think that's one of my favorite lines in the whole song. When we get to that point, it's just, oh, it's so beautiful. And then the child is really closing the eyes gradually and just this wonderful, peaceful, perfect, blissful rest. It's wonderful.
What is it like, Emily, when you're standing on the stage, because you have the best seat in the house, and you get to that, you have sung your last note, and then this all happens? Like, what is that like?
Oh, man. It's the best job. It's a dream, and it when you have the orchestra just surrounding you, it really feels like you're being lifted somewhere new. It surrounds you, and I'm sure you feel that as a conductor too. Mm-hmm. But not being the conductor, you get to kind of enjoy it more. Not so much coordination. Instead, you can kind of take the orchestra's energy and create something on top of it. It's a wonderful feeling.
Do you remember the first time you sang this?
Oh, this is my first time singing this. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And the first time with the Berg, with orchestra.
So you sang it with piano, but not with orchestra.
It's a double debut.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Good for you.
Thank you.
You'll have to let us all know how you felt it came out at the end.
Yes, of course. New experiences everywhere.
That's really great. Well, have a wonderful time singing it.
Oh, thank you.
Because it's look, a squirrel.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it feels like sometimes.
I want to thank you both for coming in. And unless there's something you would like to add to this, we will sign off a little early this time on this podcast. Thanks for being here, Ward. It's always a pleasure to have you come in.
Likewise, thank you.
Emily Brisson, so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
If you'd like some information about the Rochester Philharmonic season and next season as well, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.